Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This is New Books in Science Fiction. I'm Rob Wolf with the Those Who Cannot Edit the Past Are Condemned to Repeat It episode. Today we're going to look at love, life, history, and women's rights through the eyes of a time traveler. I think this is the fourth time travel book to be featured on the pod this year, and that's not a complaint. I love a good time travel story. For every author, time travel is something different. The science and rules of time travel always change, and the plots are on steroids because going back and forth in time, meeting yourself at different ages, changing the course of history, stories that can do that are packed with plot twists, surprises, and, of course, always a little moral mayhem. Today's time-traveling novel is The Future of Another Timeline by Annalee Newitz, which comes out this month. Annalee was on the show last year to talk about her fiction debut, Autonomous, which was nominated for the Nebula and Locus Awards and won the Lambda Literary Award. As a science journalist, they are a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times and have a monthly column in New Scientist. They are also co-hosts with Charlie Jane Anders of the podcast Our Opinions Are Correct, which just won the Hugo for Best Fan Cast. They were the founder of IO9 and served as the editor-in-chief of Gizmodo, and I'm thrilled to have them back on the show. Hi, Annalee. Thanks for joining me to talk about The Future of Another Timeline.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Congrats to you and Charlie Jane on your Hugo for Our Opinions Are Correct.
Thanks. We were really surprised and so excited that people are, you know, enjoying the podcast and listening, and so yeah, it was really fun. And now I have a giant sort of silver rocket shaped award, which is fun to play with. That sounded a little weird.
Oh,
but
it does,
I mean,
yeah.
I'm just admiring it. I'm not stroking it all the time.
Innocent play.
Yes.
As I said in the intro, the fact that your book is one time travel story among many coming out this year doesn't mean it isn't fresh and exciting. Yours, for instance, is the first time-traveling novel that I'm aware of about fighting for and restoring women's right to control their own bodies and their right to obtain a safe abortion.
That might be true. I mean, I feel like I'm in a pretty long tradition of feminist writing. And I actually, Amal El-Mohtar wrote a really interesting piece for The Guardian. She also has a time travel novel out. And
she was on the podcast. She was one of the four that I was referring
to.
Yeah,
excellent. Yeah. And I guess it's a novella. This is How You Lose the Time War, which is really great and super interesting. And she was pointing out that a lot of these new time travel books deal with queer women, and that it's this kind of upswelling of thinking about gender issues, thinking about social justice by using time. I think a lot of science fiction, maybe previously or in other decades, has sort of dealt with a lot of these same issues using dystopia, using themes around uprisings, for example, robot uprisings or worker uprisings or, you know, alien uprisings, like name your favorite uprising, you know, science fiction is there for you. And so I thought that was a really interesting observation, that somehow right now we want to be telling these stories by messing around with history itself. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that we're at a time in history when things feel really contingent. It feels like we're at a crossroads more than other times. I mean, of course, we're always technically at a crossroads. And I guess physicists would say the crossroads are like infinite. But I think, you know, most of the globe right now is in a lot of major political powers are kind of experiencing instability. It just feels like we don't know where history is going to be taking us, and we don't know where the future is going. And so a lot of us have just turned to time travel to kind of tell stories about how that feels.
So tell us a little bit about your main character, Tess, who is a geoscientist, and her present in your book is the year 2022, but it's different than the present we're living in now. Particularly, access to an abortion in her timeline is very different than it is for people today. So what are things like in her version of the year 2022?
Part of what I wanted to play with in this book was the idea that time travel has always existed. And this is kind of a thought experiment that I've always really enjoyed, which is what would it be like to live in a world where everyone knows about time travel? It's just part of the physical world. And people have been messing around with history for all of history. And of course, in my book, I had to set some limitations. Not everyone can travel through time. But theoretically, anyone could if they were willing to kind of put in the hours that it takes to train. And as a result, the timeline is very edited, and it's an alternate history. So it's very similar to our world, but not quite the same. And one of the big differences is that in the United States, abortion never became legal. The other big difference is that women got the vote in 1870, around the same time that freed slaves got the vote in the U.S. And in U.S. history, we don't talk about this very much. We tend to think of the Civil War as being kind of the defining event of the 19th century, and it's where lots of alternate histories kind of diverge. But I think that if you want to center women and people of color, that there's another alternate history that can be told there. And there was a huge battle in Congress over who would get the vote once slaves were freed. There was a long history of a women's suffrage movement and of the abolitionist movement kind of working together and working on a lot of the same questions of who gets to be a human and who gets to be a citizen and who gets to vote. And in our timeline, in reality, after the Constitution was amended to allow only freed male slaves to vote, it drove a wedge between those two groups. It drove a wedge between suffragettes, women who wanted to get the vote for women, and between members of the former abolitionist movement who wanted to get rights for freed slaves, which was basically African Americans at that time. And that changed our history in the United States. That created this thing that we talk about now, which is white feminism, which is a kind of version of feminism that's completely clueless about racial justice. And it meant that these two vital justice movements just really had a hard time working together. They were kind of at cross purposes. And I wanted to imagine, and this is very wonky, and I apologize. It's a very sort of what happens when you're a kind of social justice wonk and you re-examine the 19th century. And I really wanted to imagine what would it be like if we hadn't had that rift between those two 19th century social justice movements. What if women and freed slaves celebrated universal suffrage together? How would that change our culture? And so in some ways, the culture that Tess lives in 2022 is much more intersectional than the culture we live in now. And a lot of the feminist movements that she's part of are much, much more diverse and have been diverse for much longer. And that really has changed politics. It's changed the pop culture that she loves. And it's also changed the pop culture that some of the other characters love, because we also follow a character named Beth, who's a riot girl in 1992, and who's obsessed with this band of Mexican women who sing about racial justice and justice for immigrants, as well as feminism. And of course, riot girl bands in our timeline were much more, the ones that became famous were all largely white. And so I wanted to imagine how these little changes would happen, that you'd have a more intersectional riot girl movement. So anyway, I'm getting way off path here, but what I'm trying to say is that I wanted to think about an alternate history that I've never seen told, but that I've personally wondered about a lot as someone who's really interested in social justice and human rights and getting to keep the vote. And I often reflect on the fact that I'm only a few generations removed from being a person who wasn't allowed to vote. I just really wanted to tell a story that diverged from our reality in that way.
It's interesting that although women get the vote earlier in the alternate reality in which Tess is living in at the outset of your book, there still are all these impediments to women's access to abortion. And
yeah, I thought a lot about that. And part of it was that I didn't want to imply that things get better in a kind of perfect linear way, because I think that the way history tends to work is that one thing maybe gets better, but then another thing gets worse. And so I was imagining, well, you know, if women had gotten the vote earlier, there might have been a kind of backlash, which would have prevented a reproductive rights movement from really taking hold. And that also a more intersectional feminist movement might have centered issues around childcare and welfare a bit more than issues around abortion, because abortion rights have often been very much the purview of white feminism. Not that, of course, I mean, all feminists and intersectional feminists care about reproductive rights, but I think that when women of color have been centered in the movement, other issues have become more urgent. And I think that that was, and so those were the kind of thoughts I was having about that, was how would you have that sort of two steps forward, one step back that many of us have experienced in all kinds of rights movements.
And I guess this explains what you said earlier, that there's a lot of editing going on to history, because of course, if Tess is going to set out and say, what can I do? What changes can I make in the past to advance women's rights? And she has even an even bigger concern that there appear to be men from the future who are trying, in fact, to block the advances that women have, in fact, made, not only over their access to abortion and reproductive rights, but women's autonomy in general and women's agency and women's freedom. So she's pursuing something, but I guess my point is that when you go back to make edits, you don't know what other consequences, what you might lose, although you may gain something, you what might lose. So there's this constant give and take as both Tess and other people are trying to make changes to do something they hope will improve things overall.
Yeah, because Tess really wants to, she's sort of decided that there's this point in the 19th century where if she could intervene, she would be able to change the course of history, and women in the 20th century would have reproductive rights and would have access to abortion. And you're absolutely right. Like, she has to be constantly worried about not just the unintended consequences of an edit like that, but also the fact that her edit might take and then someone else might revert that edit, because, as you said, they're in her sort of group of subversive time traveling feminist friends have discovered that they're in an edit war over the timeline with this group of men's rights activists. And those activists are trying to make edits that roll back women's rights. We have to assume that at some point before the book started, there was a group of intersectional feminists who went back and made sure that women got the vote earlier. So they've already made that edit. And so, you know, this is what's complicated, is that like our actual history, this is a kind of living document that's constantly being changed depending on who's doing the editing. And so I definitely wanted people to kind of think about how, even though we don't travel in time, we do constantly revisit history and change history. And that process totally changes how we experience the present day. It informs our understanding of who we are, and both as individuals, but also as nations or as ethnic groups. And so, yeah, it's super complicated. Changing history turns out to be really hard.
Let's talk for a moment about Anthony Comstock. He is a big figure in the story, and he was a real person, and he is the perpetrator of events that Tess and her colleagues in the Edit War have decided are perhaps key to regaining or getting the right and access to abortion for women. So can you talk a little bit about who Anthony Comstock was and the impact he had on women's rights in the real world, meaning the world I think that you and I are in right now, assuming no one is editing it at the moment. And then,
I mean, they're editing it all the time.
Yeah, I suppose. But it feels so real.
I know. It's a consensual hallucination, as William Gibson would say. So Anthony Comstock really was an actual moralist and villain of the 19th century. He was an activist, essentially, and I kind of think of him as the first men's rights activist. And in the novel, he has these followers who we nickname the Comstockers. And they're also drawing from men's rights activist ideas from across the timeline, because this is not something that kind of rises up and disappears. It's constantly, this men's rights issue is constantly kind of erupting again. And Anthony Comstock was responsible for lobbying Congress a number of times to change America's obscenity laws in the 19th century. And at first, he was working with the YMCA, which we think of now as just like, that's a fun place to go work out or stay in a city if you need a place to sleep.
Or a nice gay anthem.
Exactly. It's fun to stay at the YMCA, but in the 19th century, it was not fun because they were an activist litigation organization they were moral crusaders for Christian values, and they were working very hard to put people in jail who they felt were dealing in obscenity, whether that was, you know, sending French postcards, which were just kind of erotic pictures, or dispensing information about birth control to women. And that information included teaching women about abortions or performing abortions. So Anthony Comstock worked with them for a while, and then the YMCA kind of dialed back on its activism. And so Comstock formed a group called the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice. And that was when he really managed to change a lot of the laws. And he went to Congress and showed a bunch of his representatives and a bunch of lawmakers all of these supposedly obscene items that he'd ordered through the mail. And he famously arrived in Washington, D.C. with a steamer trunk full of dildos, because this is very early on in the production of rubber commodities, like items made out of rubber. And so, of course, dildos were among the first to be turned into rubber items. And he just dumped them out in this congressional hearing and said, look at this horror that's coming through the mail. And so Congress made him a special agent of the Postal Service, which sounds kind of like a James Bond type thing. But basically, he was one of the first people to spy on the mail. And so in New York, he was able to look into anyone's mail coming into and out of the state and act on any obscene materials he found. And so he would finger people who were sending birth control pamphlets and information about abortion, along with people who were sending pornography and all kinds of other stuff. He was also very interested in gambling and trying to stamp out gambling through the mail. So he used to brag in his many public speeches that he'd driven a number of women to suicide by threatening them with jail for dispensing sex information. And indeed, it was true. He had driven a number of women to suicide, including Ida Craddock, who was a journalist and spiritualist. And there's a character in the novel named Sophronia who's sort of loosely based on Ida Craddock. And this was just an ongoing fight that he was involved in. And so the laws that came out of his activism were called the Comstock Laws, sort of nicknamed the Comstock Laws. And most of them were on the books in the U.S. until the 70s and 80s. And so the obscenity laws that he defined remained a huge force in U.S. politics, you know, really for almost 100 years after he died. And so he really did edit history in a sense. And so that's why my characters feel like if they could just figure out a way to intervene somehow in his career, that they could revert that edit or make a new edit to bring reproductive rights back to women. And so that's part of their mission. And it actually winds up taking them really far back in time. Like they go back to the 19th century to have a showdown with him at the Chicago World's Fair, which is entirely based on events that really did happen at the World's Fair. Not all of them. There were no time travelers at the World's Fair, as far as we know. And then they have to go back even further. And so it was super fun because initially, when I was working on the book, I was like, oh, we're just going to go to the 19th century. And then I was like, oh, actually, we're going to go to antiquity. And then we're going to go back to, like, you know, half a billion years ago, just for fun, because why not? And so, so this sets off this quest, winds up, you know, really taking us deep into history.
This is a great time then to talk about the debate that some of your characters have, which is the great man theory versus, I guess it's the collective action theory, and trying to figure out, do they just need to shoot Comstock in the head, or is changing hearts and minds in a bigger and broader way, is that going to be more successful? It's an interesting idea. I think it's an idea that people have to this day, and it even comes to mind. I mean, I can't help but think of Donald Trump and the various strongmen around the world and wondering, can these people who are seemingly trying to unravel the social fabric in different ways, you know, is their impact going to last, or are the institutions and the collective that opposes them, will they ultimately prevail? It just seems very relevant, even though in your story, it's applied to the sort of fictional time traveling setting.
Yeah. And I mean, a big part of the book, because these characters are scientists, is, you know, to a certain extent, them having debates and beating their heads against the wall because they don't really understand how history works. I mean, nobody understands how history works. We'd love if it were just as easy as, you know, kind of classical physics where, you know, you throw something in the air and it comes down and it just seems to work. And not only that, but they also don't understand really how these time machines work that they're using. They've, you know, ancient people thousands of years ago discovered that if you kind of pounded on a piece of rock in a certain place, it would open up this wormhole that, if you were, you know, an ancient person, you thought took you into a magical world. And in the modern world of science, you know, these characters know that they're wormholes. They know that there's some kind of mechanism built into these rocks that they've found that allows them to open a wormhole, but they don't know why. They don't know if somebody built it, if it's some kind of natural phenomenon. And it's the same thing with history. They're like, well, you know, there's two theories. One is that history is driven by great men, like you said, that it's certain people like Anthony Comstock or Ronald Reagan or, you know, Napoleon, that these are the people who change the timeline. And other people, including the main characters who are activists, believe that history can only be changed through collective action, through changing the actions and the beliefs of many, many, many people who, working together, can alter history. So this debate has led to a lot of experimentation. And so one of the things that the characters talk about is that there's clear evidence that time travelers tried to stop several different leaders before Napoleon rose, and that he's actually like the fourth or fifth guy to come along and was kind of the worst of the bunch. And every time they killed a guy who was doing, you know, who was engaging in kind of imperialism in Europe at that time, a new guy came along who was worse. And so this is a time travel scenario where you can go back and kill Hitler, but it won't do any good because like Bitler or Zitler will take over and you'll still have a horrific, you know, genocide, and you'll have a world war. And that, to the main characters like Tess and her friends, that's evidence to them that collective action is really the only way to change history. Because the reason why it doesn't matter if you kill Anthony Comstock is because it's not really about him. It's about a whole bunch of people who agree with him. It's about these men's rights activists. And there's many, many of them all across the timeline. So it doesn't make sense to kill anyone. It only makes sense to try to change a bunch of people's minds. So how the heck do you do that? And that is their big quest, is to figure out how you do that. And of course, it's by political organizing, which is exactly what we do now to try to change people's minds. And it's hard and it takes a long time. And these time travelers in my book, when they go back in history to make edits, sometimes they stay in history for, you know, 5 or 10 years because they have to spend so much time doing this. So it's, you know, it'd be nice if you could just shoot Anthony Comstock, but they don't think that that will work. Although there's some debate. There is one character who's pretty sure that she just wants to kill him, and they have to kind of restrain her from doing that.
And she's got this nifty tool that lets her do pretty much anything. So if she wanted to, she could do it pretty easily.
It seems like it, right? I needed to have a sonic screwdriver in this book, so I gave one character from the future. Basically, it's called a multi-tool, but when you read it, you'll know it's a sonic screwdriver.
Well, another reason they have to spend sometimes so many years, especially in the past, is because transportation is so slow. There's all of these moments where there are five portals or five places where there are these time machines built into the rock, these basically mysterious origin geo phenomenon that allow them to time travel. But inconveniently, they're located in these far-flung places, at least far-flung from Chicago. So, you know, when Tess travels, she always has to make time for 3 weeks of canoeing from Canada and trading pelts along the way before she gets where she wants to go. So that's an accommodation I guess you have to make when you travel to the past.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I really wanted to play with in this book was the relationship between space and time. And, you know, in a lot of time travel stories, people have a machine so they can just kind of like drive it anywhere and then boop, they go into the past. But these machines, if they are machines, are built into the Earth's crust. They're built into these really ancient shield rock formations. And the nearest one to Tess, who teaches at UCLA, is in Flin Flon, Manitoba, in Canada. It's kind of northern Manitoba. And, you know, to get there, even now, as someone, I've had to travel to Saskatchewan, which is next door to Manitoba, a number of times, and it's still, you usually have to take like 3 planes to get there, because there's not a lot of direct flights from San Francisco to Saskatchewan, anywhere in Saskatchewan. So she has to fly there in the 21st century, and then once she gets to the 19th century, good luck getting from northern Manitoba to Chicago. So I had a lot of fun reading about ancient transit routes in Canada to get her around. And yeah, she has to, you know, getting Flin Flon was like a mining camp in the 19th century. So she's got to take a canoe and then take a train. And her back really hurts by the time she gets there because sleeping on a train really sucks. So yeah, I wanted it to feel realistic somehow. Like, I wanted to have time travel that didn't feel effortless. And so that was an easy constraint to put in there, was just, well, you got to go to a place, and that place might be relatively accessible in the 21st century, but if you go back too far, it's going to be a pain in the ass.
Well, I love how the people who work at these places at various times, you know, she goes back in time and they're always wearing something different and they're speaking different languages, but they're used to time travel. Like, they have a different, you know, they don't have TVs and internet, but they know time travelers. It's like, oh, where are you from? Oh, you're from 500 years in the future. Yeah, yawn. So where do you want to go? You know, where
can I help? It's definitely mundane time travel. And I love that. You know, I love making, sort of demystifying it and turning it into just like, well, this is a thing that some people do. And, you know, it's just like air travel. You know, when you get out of the airplane in Morocco, people are speaking a different language and they're just used to weird people coming from outside Africa to visit. So they're just whatever. It's just like on Earth now, but without time travel, just space travel on Earth. I mean, that sounds weird, but just, you know what I mean? Traveling through space on Earth is weird enough. And so adding in time travel doesn't really seem like that much.
I guess, you know, people can get used to anything, I think, ultimately is what it is. So it seems perfectly realistic when you enter the world of your book that that's how people would respond.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, time travel's been around forever, as far as they know. So it's just, yeah, it's a normal part of traveling.
While a significant portion of the book focuses on Tess as an adult and her time traveling adventures and her efforts to change history, there's also part of the story that goes back to 1992 Irvine. And some things happen then, things that there's some regret for. And so Tess tries to use time travel to fix some of the damage and also maybe fix something inside her.
Yeah, I mean, the novel switches back and forth between two points of view, and we're learning about sort of a huge chunk of history through Tess. And then the other character is a teenage riot girl named Beth, who is stuck in time. She can't move around in time. And she has some connection to Tess, to Tess's childhood. And it's kind of part of the fun of the book is figuring out what that connection is. But as you said, I mean, part of the reason why Tess is drawn to go back to 1992 is she wants to fix something that's happened in her own past. And this is like double forbidden. Like, she's already trying to change history, which is kind of forbidden within her profession as a geoscientist. But also, she's been told over and over that you can't change your own past. And if you do, it can have incredibly dire consequences. But she's drawn to it anyway. And so we meet this character, Beth, who is struggling with, well, just getting through high school in the Southern California suburbs. And she also has a really abusive dad. And her friends, her riot girl friends, decide it's going to be a great idea in the name of feminism to start murdering rapists and creepers. So she's got a lot that she's dealing with. And then this time traveler shows up in her life. And she's like, what is happening? And so, you know, high school's hard. And sometimes there's a little murder and sometimes there's a little time travel involved. And the relationship between Beth's journey just trying to grow up and Tess's journey trying to revisit the past of the nation, you know, go back to the 19th century, kind of unfold in parallel. And I really wanted to have a character that would ground us in history and that would kind of provide the perspective of someone who doesn't have the freedom to kind of just move around and change things. And she's having to just deal with changing her life in the present, even though her life is so weird that it's almost, I mean, her life has almost taken on a kind of science fictional glow at that point because things have gotten so strange. But that is, again, how kind of high school feels a lot of the time. So I wanted to have those two contrasting points of view. And both Beth, the riot girl, and Tess, the time traveler, are dealing with violence. They're dealing with, you know, men around them who are trying to hurt them in different kinds of ways, and they're struggling with what's the appropriate response. Like, should you just murder a guy? Should you try to use political organizing to prevent that guy from being able to hurt you? And of course, there's a lot of other questions as well, like a lot of different approaches that these characters are taking to basically the same question, which is, how do you deal with a society where women are being put into vulnerable positions all the time? So I really liked having that contrast. And then, of course, there's a whole mystery about who are Tess and Beth and why do they keep running into each other in the timeline.
And for you, there's a bit of a personal element, I gather, in a postscript where you talk about historical sources, you say that some of the teen experiences that are described, you know, you're drawing on your own experiences, at least about what it was like to live in Irvine and Los Angeles in 1992. And you also write that your dad suffered from depression, and Beth's father, as you've said, is very cruel. And apparently a lot of that has to do with his own mental illness, the fact that he imposes really harsh and arbitrary rules and is really denigrating to his daughter. You know, I felt so bad for her. And to the extent that any of that represents your experience, I felt really bad for you.
Well, thanks. A lot of it is based on, especially the setting is based on where I grew up. I grew up in Irvine, California, and I did not engage in murder, although maybe might have thought about it and seen a lot of movies about it. And so I wanted to have, I did a lot of historical research for the book to kind of recreate, you know, Chicago in the late 19th century. And I was like, well, why don't I do some research into my own past to kind of recreate Irvine in 1992? And so I went back and looked at my journals that I'd written when I was a teenager. I talked to some friends of mine who lived through it with me and also escaped from Irvine, and really recreated at a pretty granular level what it was like to be in this place that was really right-wing and conservative, and to be someone who didn't conform to that, and what that was like. And I did have not exactly the same experiences that Beth has with her father, but I did have a very abusive father who was very tortured by stuff that he dealt with in his own past. And it was very clear to me many years later, you know, once I was an adult, you know, kind of what had been torturing him and how he was kind of not even necessarily aware of what he was doing. And he, like a lot of the characters in my novel, my dad committed suicide. And so you'll notice that there's a lot of people being rescued from committing suicide. It's sort of a sub theme. And I mean, after all, Anthony Comstock, the bad guy, was really into the idea of forcing people to commit suicide. And it's still something you see a lot online when feminists are being hassled and griefed by people online. They're often told, go commit suicide. And so I have a little, you know, as a fiction writer, I get to have a few compensatory fantasies here and there. And so one of my little fantasies in that book is getting to stop some suicides before they happen, because it's preventable. And the way it's prevented is with the same mechanism that you change history. It's through collective action. It's through people being there for each other. And so I really wanted to have kind of a therapeutic aspect to this fantasy. And so part of it was therapeutic for me, and part of it, I hope, is therapeutic for the reader, getting to see these characters, you know, undergo pretty intense trauma and then start to heal from it. So yeah, that was a part of the book that was, like, I guess not surprisingly, kind of cathartic. It's like, that's sort of the definition of catharsis. So I was glad that I was able to kind of bring that in.
In order to write about those things that are so close to your experience, I imagine, though, you have to have already processed a lot of it to feel ready to express it so articulately, so both cathartic in the process of doing it, but you must have already been at a pretty healed place.
I think so. I mean, I had a lot of therapy, good therapy that was very helpful. And I've been very lucky to have super supportive friends and partners who have been there for me. And so I got really lucky. Not everybody has that. And my dad didn't have that, which is part of why he committed suicide. He just didn't have a support network at all. And that's one of the things that happens in depression, is that you drive people away who might want to help you. And so I think, you know, I'm a grown up now. And so I have enough distance from a lot of it that it felt like a good time to write about it. And it felt like, just especially in the last few years, so many of my friends have been depressed that I really just wanted to grapple with that in my fiction. And so You know, and we always draw on our own personal experience. And I want to emphasize, this is not an autobiography. You know, there's a lot of stuff that's very different. And so I think what's true to my own experience is really the emotional part of it. And then a few details here and there are definitely autobiographical, but a lot of it is just made up. And that's another way I think that fiction allows us to get kind of distance on things that have happened to us, is that we get to kind of make shit up. And somehow in the act of doing that, it's healing as well, getting to kind of turn it into a story that isn't really about me anymore.
Well, what is next? What are you working on? And what can we expect from you in the future of this timeline?
So I am just finishing up a nonfiction book, which is about archaeology. And it's about four great cities in history that were abandoned, ancient cities. So nothing newer than 1,000 years old. And I actually have been working on this book for quite a while. It's coming out probably late next year. And I wrote Future of Another Timeline kind of in the middle of working on this book, because when you're writing about archaeology, like, all you do all day is wish that you had a time machine. So I was like, great, I'm just going to do that. So that book's called Four Lost Cities, and you can look for that fall next year. And then I've signed a contract with Tor Books, who published Future of Another Timeline, to do two more novels for them. And so those will be coming out, I don't know, 2-3 years from now. And one of those is about far future terraforming project. And I'm really excited about that. It's like a multi-generational terraforming epic that's kind of about water rights, really. But it's also about terraforming. And then there'll be another novel after that, which I think might be a kaiju love story.
Is it intimidating to think of all those deadlines approaching, or is it inspiring?
It's super inspiring and also very like relieving, because I think as a writer, especially as someone, I'm a freelancer, like I'm not on staff anywhere. So knowing that I have those books in the future makes me feel like, okay, I know what I'm doing. Like, I have stuff, you know, I've got a plan. It's really nice. So, I'm super grateful that, you know, Tor likes me enough to want to buy more books from me instead. And Norton, who's publishing my nonfiction book. I'm very grateful to them too, because they had to wait a little extra time while I finished this novel. So yeah, I just feel insanely happy and lucky. And all I want to do is type things really fast.
Well, fantastic. And congratulations on the publication of The Future of Another Timeline and all these great upcoming projects, and on your Hugo. And thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Annalee Newitz. Their novel, The Future of Another Timeline, is out this month from Tor. This is New Books in Science Fiction. If you don't already subscribe, please do, and leave a review. Our theme music is by Michael Aaron of QuiverNYC.com. The editor-in-chief and founder of the New Books Network is Marshall Poe, and the editor is Leanne Wilson. I'm Rob Wolf. I'm the author of The Alternate Universe. Find out more about me at robwolf.net and on Twitter at robwolfbooks. Thanks for dropping by. I know you've got a lot of podcasts to choose from, so it means a lot to me that you've taken the time to listen.